Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, should we be allowing David Cameron back into pubs after the COVID pandemic, given that he previously left his daughter in one unattended?
Oh my god, brilliant reference, Jimmy. One of your best opening questions, I have to say. I don't think that Cameron should be allowed out in public to speak in public to have any I think we should de-platform David Cameron. I think that whenever he appears in the news at the moment, it just seems to really highlight that he's a bit of a shit who left the country in a worse state than how he found it, which is a big thing considering he came in after the financial crisis in 2010.
I mean, he sort of deplatformed himself by standing down as an MP. I note that Theresa May, his successor as Prime Minister, is still in the House of Commons.
And look, everybody fucking loves her now, don't they? Like, she's sassy as fuck.
Well, I mean, love in the sense that whenever she criticises Boris Johnson, it's like, ooh. Former Prime Minister criticises her former
current
Home Secretary.
Prime Minister.
As was. Yeah,
current yeah, Prime Minister. But we knew that was going to happen. He's a twat, isn't he?
In sort of saying this question, which I agree is one of my better ones for opening this podcast, I've kind of wrapped in two topics that we're going to be discussing.
Yes, very good. By the way, hello, dear listener. This is very much the tone of the podcast that we have here. We talk about politics, social issues and current events. Yeah. On a fortnightly basis.
It is now fortnightly and surprisingly regular for us, I would say.
Unlike my bowel movements.
Amazing. So the first topic we are going to be discussing is not actually directly related to David Cameron. It's about the pub thing. There's various talks going on at the moment.
It's not specifically a pub thing. It's just like a general events thing.
This country
is so obsessed with when we can go back to the pub, when we can be inside a pub, when we can be outside a pub, when we can look at a pub as the restrictions come out. There's even a website that counts down the different stages of unlocking lockdown based on how many beers you can have with certain numbers of people.
Wow.
I believe we're currently at 6 beers outside. Beers outside with maximum of 6 people.
Yeah, the rule of 6 is still in place.
And then pub gardens, beer gardens are open in like 2 weeks on the 17th of April.
That is correct. 12th of April, actually.
Sorry, 12th of April.
Yeah, we're very near.
Sorry, I'm booked in for the 17th of April.
You know, obviously the world does revolve around your social calendar, Jazza.
Thank you for admitting that.
But I suppose as you know, millennials who don't have children, the pub thing has been the major disruption to my past year, I would say, is not being allowed to go to the pub. It's probably been the most significant way I've been negatively affected, I would say.
What a sad existence you live.
Well, I prefer working from home, so that's been a benefit for me.
I can travel. I've now had to start ordering my groceries, which as somebody who detests planning, I can't stand. I'm having a horrible time, Jimmy.
I mean, yeah, there is all the, you know, death and destruction and...
Like 140,000 people dead.
But most importantly, Jazza, I can't go to the pub. And under these plans that are...
I can't believe this comes mere seconds after you tell me off for having everything centering around me.
Wow, I mean, hypocrisy is not really a sin, is it?
It's know, almost
just a way
part
of life.
Our brand, though, isn't it?
But the government is sort of, I say it's planning, it's sort of been floating this idea around the media, I think, to see what the reaction is likely to be. That when we go back to pubs and restaurants and events generally, I should say, we'll have to prove that we've been vaccinated in some way.
They're piloting a scheme that would mean that we'd have to prove that we got vaccinated.
Yeah, well, it's about to be in the piloting stage. There's a comedy night in Liverpool which will undergo trials of these COVID passports from the 16th of April.
Ironically, not a very funny thing for them to be trialing, I would say.
What
percentage of the gags on the night do you think are going to be centered around the fact that everybody there had to be vaccinated?
Probably every stand-up's opening gag, I would
100%.
Say. I'm assuming it's a stand-up comedy thing. So We're not entirely sure how this is going to work exactly. I mean, Jazza, you've previously said to me that we sort of don't really have any of the infrastructure that would be necessary to pull off a scheme like this. We don't have a national ID card. We're going to have to build this from scratch, roughly speaking, aren't we? The ability to actually show that we've been vaccinated or not.
Yeah, which actually is completely fine because we know how great we are at building infrastructure projects like apps and things like that on the back of the taxpayer without any pre-existing infrastructure, right? We know that we're good at that and that never goes wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the case that there was some sort of track and trace system developed in the last year.
That has been applauded as being absolutely terrible.
Hugely costly, utterly ineffective, completely useless. How are any of these people ever going to be employed again? Levels of crap.
Oh, Jimmy, I know a couple of the people who've worked on it and I just feel very sorry for them.
It's fine, these sort of people fail upwards, don't they?
Yeah, sure.
So we are going to be talking about that, segueing into our friend David Cameron, who, as we said earlier, did leave his daughter in the pub unattended, which I think should probably have disqualified him from future office, to be honest, but he managed to do that for himself anyway a couple of years later. He's been found out.
I don't know. Can I just say, I feel like my parents did worse to me when I was growing up and I'm fine. Like, I've been forgotten in places before. And to be fair, I was an obnoxious child. I probably deserved it. It was character building.
I mean, forgotten... I'm sure that's what your dad said to you. So anyway, David Cameron has been he's been accused of lobbying, and I mean that essentially is what he was doing. He's been for some reason, this is how the rules work in this country, he was cleared of lobbying charges on the grounds that he wasn't an official registered lobbyist but just an employee of this company, Greensill Capital. Greensill was involved in like supply chain financing, and it was
basically in order to pay someone a company. I've looked this up, Jimmy. In order to pay someone, like a big company, will get Greensill to come in and deal with that account, so it gets paid quicker than if it came directly from, say, the big company that's paying a freelancer or something.
Yeah, and David Cameron was seeking changes to COVID-19 loan schemes to the benefit of Greensill, which, as we said, he was employed with. It doesn't say, I haven't been able to find out what salary he was being paid, but he did have some share options which were worth up to $70 million, according to the Financial Times.
Which would double his net worth. He is currently worth about £40 million, is what Wikipedia says. And that's not a small amount of money. They were saying on the on Times Radio earlier this week that really does dwarf in comparison the amount of profits that Tony Blair made after he left the office of Prime Minister, and he's often seen as one of the sleaziest.
He is. So I guess we're going to be talking about lobbying rules, the sort of revolving door between government and private business, and what exactly Prime Ministers should do once they've stood down from Downing Street. All of that fun stuff.
Jazza, go away.
Jazza, what's the final topic that we are going to be discussing?
So Keir Starmer, or as Jimmy reported this week on the website, apparently the left are calling him Keith Starmer, which is
we've only just discovered this, but it is several months old, so apologies.
Oh, is it? Okay, sorry. Well, don't come to us for your up-to-date news, listener, let's be fair. But he, in the run, today is a weird day. We're recording this on Easter Sunday, and I am furious that everything is shut because I'm not a Christian. Like, I've been technically I am a Christian because I've been confirmed and everything. I had to learn all of that shit. Had that colouring book for Sunday school. Also, I could go to the local C of E primary. But there's kind of in the run up to Christmas. To Christmas, to Easter. Keir Starmer visited Jesus House, which is originally a Nigerian church that has its biggest presence in the UK in West London. Is it in Brent?
Brent Cross, North West London, yes.
He went To look at kind of, because it's also a vaccine center, so he went to look at the vaccine center, but then also prayed a little bit with the pastor there and with the local MP, Dawn Butler.
Has it been confirmed that he prayed there? Because there's a
video. It looks like, quote unquote, looks like he was praying.
It does look like he was praying, yeah.
You know what? What is praying? Is it just saying, yo, God?
He certainly has his head bowed while it appears that the pastor is doing something that looks like praying.
Yeah.
There's not the relevant sound on that part of the clip. So.
And he was criticised because this church and this pastor have been criticised in the past and are well known for actively campaigning against LGBT rights in the UK.
Specifically, they've opposed same-sex marriage legislation in 2013.
And civil union legislation, yeah. And in the branches of the church in Nigeria regularly, what's the word? They regularly preach against gay rights specifically. Mm. This came under fire from a lot of people from
From Jazz's corner of the internet.
My corner of the internet, yeah. Me and Owen Jones, really. It's just us two. We have a lot more fun than you and Tom Harwood do, Jimmy, I'll be honest.
Me and Tom are not buddies. He won't respond to my messages. He doesn't take my calls.
Poor thing.
Devastating.
So specifically this pastor, because he's been a signatory on a load of anti-LGBT rights kind of like campaigns and stuff like that. Theresa May also visited the church in 2017 and was widely criticised for the same reason. Boris Johnson, when he was mayor of London in 2010, this was a long time ago, was also criticised in a similar way back then. People are surprised that Keir Starmer's team can't Google.
Well, yeah. I feel like we're sort of delving a little bit too far into the topic, and I know you want to save your righteous energy for when we get to it.
Don't patronise me, Jimmy Nichols.
So maybe right now we should, before you do that, we should play some music, talk about the Patreon account, and then we can start off with our first segment. Does that sound good?
Yeah, sure, fine. I feel like we've already started. Sure, fine.
If you are a fan of the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. There you can subscribe to us on an episodic basis, which gives you access to exclusive segments that we do not release to anybody else. Our current patrons include Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Michael Costa. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Also, if you don't think you're getting enough from me on this podcast, you can read my weekly newsletter on politics and other things at jdenichols.substack.com. Also, you can watch Jazza play Pokemon on his YouTube gaming channel, which for some reason can be found at youtube.com/jazzainchina. That's probably enough advertising for one episode, so now on with the show. So, Jazza, what strikes me as the most fundamental flaw in this COVID passport shenanigan is that I don't appear to be within any sort of sight of getting a vaccine. And if I was required to have one to enter the pub, I wouldn't be able to enter the pub, when things open. In theory, so the outdoor opening of pubs is the 12th of April. I want to say that May 17th is the indoor opening of pubs.
Yes, that's correct. It's the day after my birthday. Thank you for reminding me. and I will be postponing my birthday celebrations until the 17th. Thank you very much.
I await my invite in the post eagerly.
Mm-hmm. The post.
So, we've both in our own way made this entirely about our own social calendars. But I mean, the fact that a lot of people won't necessarily be vaccinated, I don't think, not even their first vaccine shot by the time the pubs open and other indoor venues open. This is not just about pubs, although it clearly is mostly about pubs. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the first among several problems with this plan, don't you think?
From what I understand, these trials are just that, trials for when once everybody has been offered the vaccine, then something like this would actually roll out more broadly.
Am I to take it then that before everyone has been offered one vaccine shot, people are going to be allowed to go into indoor venues irrespective of whether they've had...
Well, no, because we'll still be coming out of lockdown. Okay. Then, right? So
you think that everyone would have been offered one vaccine by the time, by May 17th, basically?
Yeah, well, we should get our first dose of the vaccine by May, June.
Okay.
Like, if the... As long, I mean, fingers crossed, as long as the supply chains don't bugger up, we should be getting ours as young whippersnappers as we are around May, June. Our first ones anyway. And I think like over the summer is when they would, I assume is when they would end up rolling out kind of like a final version of this scheme. I still think it's a bloody stupid idea.
Well, presumably they should roll it out from May 17th, because it's absurd to have a situation where people are allowed to go into indoor venues without a COVID passport, and then it's introduced, you know, even a couple of weeks later. That just seems really absurd, don't you think?
Well, the idea is that in... Yeah.
Have I missed something? Like, I feel like a lot of the government's COVID plans, like, I read them, I'm like, there seems to be some obvious problems with this, but am I stupid or is the government stupid? Or are we both stupid? Which I guess is possible. They don't have to be mutually exclusive.
I think it's a little from column A, little from column B, Jimmy. I'll be honest. But... So there is usefulness in the kinds... So that it isn't... On the 17th of May, we'll be able to socialise with six other people inside, which is very different to what I assume the vaccine passport thing is going to be prepping us for, which would be as many people everywhere, inside, outside, upstairs, downstairs, etc., etc.
So these are these like venues where people can sort of move around a bit more freely, like football stadiums or...
Well, yeah, you know. The trials are going to be football stadiums, and they're going... You mentioned one of the first trials is going to be a comedy club, which are... Like, it's generally those places, and I assume they'll still have these, but those places have been turning to, not football stadiums, but comedy clubs have had to have seats and chairs to be able to... have those restrictions rather than have like standing people standing in kind of like a big club as it probably usually would be. I don't, from what I understand, this isn't meant to replace the social distancing rules that places have had and that we're planning on places having as we ease lockdowns, but I just think it's it just feels like an unnecessary piece of infrastructure that will, as you said, end up being created by like a team that haven't actually done particularly well at doing like test and trace and stuff like that. And also, it doesn't take in like vaccines are great, but they are part of the solution to us going to a more normal life.
So I should say, even though the passport would say whether you've been vaccinated, it can also include information such as whether you've had a recent negative test or you've had a natural immunity because you've been tested, you've tested positive for COVID and therefore have developed the relevant antibodies. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit broader than vaccines, but I mean, actually, that makes it sound even more technologically complicated, because at least if it was a vaccine thing, you could get the NHS.
That's going to have to plug into certify. So many different ones.
Yeah. I mean, there's APIs all over the shop here, by the sounds of things.
And then there's also the fact that vaccine, like we from what I'm preempting everything here that is like science based with from what I understand, because I am not an immunologist, but. We now know that the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is not effective against the South African variant.
Oh my!
We've only had a handful of cases in the UK so far, but vaccines are possibly only going to get us so far.
To be fair, this isn't about totally eliminating risk associated with COVID. This is about mitigating the risk, isn't
it? It's the Swiss cheese model. Have you seen him talk about that at the podium?
I'm afraid I haven't. You'll have to enlighten me.
So Swiss cheese has holes in it. So and each method is a slice of Swiss cheese. And so you need lots of different methods / slices of Swiss cheese in order to get a full barrier.
I see.
it's a lot easier to understand and explain with visual aids.
I guess it works as a metaphor. If you sort of stacked up several slices of Swiss cheese,
exactly.
Which people do all the time, don't they? That's very common.
Oh, shut up.
Another success for the government comms department. It does like intuitively make sense. I guess this sort of like shades into the argument about people's obligation to get a jab. So obviously there are still some holdouts. There are some vaccine skeptics who don't want it because they argue it hasn't been sufficiently tested. But you know, seemingly lots and lots of people have had it now, and there hasn't been evidence that it has caused, you know, problems, basically, by and large. But, you know, there's still going to be people who don't want to get a vaccine. And one of the original arguments around this was, were you effectively going to create a sort of two tiers of lifestyle whereby people who agree to have the vaccine are allowed to go to indoor events, and then people who haven't had it are not allowed to go to these events? I mean, the argument seems to have moved on a little bit, I would say. There's this weird metaphor that I actually, just sort of looking it up here, it's Baroness Chakrabarty, who was the Labour's former Attorney General.
Lady Shammy
Chakrabarty. And she was also a campaigner. I think she was the Director of Liberty.
She was the Director of Liberty. Yeah,
which is a civil rights group. And she
also carried the Olympic flag at the 2012 opening ceremony alongside Muhammad Ali.
Okay, we don't need her full CV here, Jazza. I think we've gone far enough. But she talks about introducing two queues at the cinema, two queues at the football stadium, and so on. And describes it as a checkpoint Britain, which I assume sort of references things like Checkpoint Charlie and, you know, these like border controls and that kind of thing.
I mean, so putting it like that reminds me I wasn't in Northern Ireland in the 90s, but it reminds me of kind of like the vibe of Northern Ireland in the 90s, of going over not just border checks, but checks, but army checks, whether you were a school bus or a van or a lorry or whatever.
I mean, I think that's a little bit hyperbolic in some ways. I mean, as much as I think I've indicated that I'm very fond of the pub, I think not being allowed to go in one because you don't have a vaccine is not the most grievous infringement on someone's human rights that can be imagined. And I don't get the two queues thing. Like, we were discussing this before we started recording, and I think if they introduce this system, it's not like it's not going to be like VIP tickets and normal person tickets. It's not like a skip to the front of the queue thing. I assume it would be, if you have a COVID passport, you're allowed in. If you don't have one, you're not. I mean, that
yeah. So actually, it's one queue, but it's fewer people who can be in the queue. Yeah, so do you think, it's a metaphor, Jimmy. I don't, like, you're a writer.
I don't think it is a metaphor. I think there's going to be two queues.
No, I don't know. I think it's a metaphor, Jimmy. It's not literally two queues. We don't know enough. We don't have that information, do we?
No, I think she's just misunderstood what's happening.
No, I think you're just being a blunt idiot. Like, what? It's a metaphor of, like, one rule for someone and one rule for someone else.
I mean, it's the same rules for everyone. It's just, if you don't have this paperwork,
oh
you can't
God,
come
no,
in.
No, you're a tit. No, you're a tit.
Okay, we can move on from the two queues dispute. Interestingly, along with Chakrabarty, Jeremy Corbyn is opposing the COVID passports.
Why are we talking about him?
We can still talk. Weirdly, here it says Labour's Jeremy Corbyn, and strictly speaking, this is a BBC report.
He's
not a Labour MP. Although he is a member of the Labour Party,
correct.
So small, sort of lowercase member. Senior Tory Ian Duncan Smith.
A lowercase member means something very different to me.
Get your mind out the gutter, sir. And Ed Davey and the Liberal Democrats, if you remember them, have all united. It's created this strange coalition of strange bedfellows. who are all united in opposing the COVID passport.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's cute that Jeremy Corbyn is still getting quoted in these things, but I think I'm broadly on their side, though. Like, I am wary of the hyperbole of slippery slope arguments, but of all of the governments that could possibly be rolling this out, I would want Priti Patel nowhere near my vaccine information. Because I don't trust the authoritarianism that is kind of like bubbling underneath the otherwise relatively normal government machine.
What exactly do you think that Priti Patel is going to do with your vaccine information?
I don't know.
I mean, also, she already has it, you do realise. Like, that's how they know who to offer
But having the information, and this is now them doing something with it. It makes me really, really uncomfortable. And I think, I can't really articulate what part of it makes me uncomfortable. I just don't trust them to get it right.
I also just think, and also that their reputation for incompetence is well established.
This is possibly something that's going to end up affecting younger people a lot more than older people, which is
not the young people.
I mean, but they don't care about anybody under the age of 35, do they? Because no one under the age of 35 votes for these nutters anyway. and so they don't think about our demographic at all when it comes to these kinds of things. If it makes over 70s feel safer, which they will do because everybody over 70, like, what is it? It's like 85% uptake in the over 70s. Or something. I think it's over 90, actually.
I don't know. I assume it's pretty high.
The vaccine. They're fine. Like, their lives will not be affected by this. Whereas younger people do not need to take the vaccine nearly as much as older people, and so should have the right to decide not to take it. To be fair, I think that you should take. Full disclosure, I think that you should take the vaccine if you are offered it, regardless as to your age. But you can understand why a younger person would decide not to.
But I mean, strictly, this is about what's known in economics as externalities, i.e., you can choose to like not take the vaccine, and that in turn increases the risk that you would transmit the virus to somebody else, particularly if you're somebody who would be asymptomatic if you contracted COVID, which would be more
but
likely
then,
to be
but
young
then,
people, right?
But then the vaccine, like the, then there's this illusion of choice of, oh, we're never going to force anybody to take a vaccine, but actually you won't be able to go to the pub if you don't take it. Well, that basically, in a British society obsessed with the fucking pub, where everything is framed in the context of what it means for your local Wetherspoons, it basically means that you have to take the vaccine.
I don't know that it does, really. I think I pretty much align with you. I just don't think that it's... I don't think it is as grievous a breach of somebody's human rights. I think it's a fair thing to say, look, you don't have to take the vaccine, but in not taking the vaccine, you are putting other people at risk, which is accurate as a statement. And therefore, we don't think you should be allowed to go into indoor venues where we know the risk of spreading COVID is higher. Those are that is a complete logical chain.
I agree with... I agree with all of those things. I'm just really skeptical about it. Like, it just really makes me uncomfortable.
I mean, as I said, the government's previous record on track and trace does not instill anyone with confidence, I think.
And also, what incentives are private businesses going to have to actually enforce this? You remember over the summer where it was like, you can only sit down with people, you can only have X number of people from your own household, and it was obvious that half of the people at Wagamama's were definitely not from the same household.
Well, I think people have been regularly flouting the rules.
Present
company accepted, obviously.
Of course they have. But they are not... There's no incentive for a private business that needs that custom to actually be thoroughly policing this and turning people away.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole substantial meal thing, the way that a lot of places were getting
Scotch
around
egg.
There was the whole Scotch egg thing, but also if you had any food left on your plate, and that would include, you know, a lettuce leaf or something, they would deem that you were still eating, quote unquote. And they would definitely
to be fair, you try and take a plate with like two chips on it away from me, and I will roughly tackle you to the ground. I think that's accurate.
Well, that's not very COVID friendly, Jazza. That level of physical contact.
Then don't take my chips away from me.
I'm just saying. I mean, no, I totally agree with you. These pubs need the custom. Pubs and indoor venues generally, they're not...
Again, it's always pubs. The only business we care about seems to be the pub. They're close. Like, we don't go to them. Before lockdown, we never went to them anymore. Like, they were struggling businesses.
There
was like one closing every day or something in Britain, wasn't there?
So, some people argue that the pubs have never really recovered from the smoking ban, which I think was implemented in 2007 or round about then, maybe a little bit earlier.
Did people stop going to pubs because of the smoking ban?
Wow, this is the allegation.
Didn't people just stop people stopped smoking and started smoking outside?
I don't know. We'd have to get someone on who understands the pub industry.
I'll call up Nigel Farage.
I mean, he's been single-handedly keeping the pub industry afloat these past couple of years. He's a one-man advertising campaign for the British pub.
For not going to the pub, I would argue. Look at him, poor guy.
I don't know what you mean. I'm sure he'd be a great guy to have a drink with.
He is the same age as Brad Pitt.
Yes. I think that it's an unfair comparison, though. Brad Pitt has had quite an easy life in many ways. And has access to all the best fitness people.
I think Nigel Farage has done pretty okay for himself. If he wanted to look after himself, he could. He is notoriously quite well off.
He is pretty well off, to be fair. But I don't know. It's that tough city metal trader living, I guess. Just takes it out of you. Mm-hmm. Speaking of finance, Jazza, should we talk about Greensill Capital, David Cameron's now former employer?
Great. Can I just say, I really resent this story because it was one of the... Because I don't like reading about finance at the best of times. But I've now had to understand...
You suggested this story.
I did. I want to have
on the record.
I did. I'm a glutton for self-flagellation. And this... Greensill is a very confusing company in terms of like what they do and why they exist. They exist in kind of like without bureaucracy. This company does nothing. Like it's just a services company that essentially, in order to process payments quicker, it goes into debt for the company that it's processing the payments on behalf of, and then pays them back with the next round. It's like it's in this weird, really hyper logistics focused middle ground of like financial payments, and I hate it.
I mean, it doesn't sound unusually complicated for the financial services industry, I wouldn't say.
Jimmy, I did a BA. I do not understand any of this bullshit.
I think most of people working the city did an English degree or something like that.
Exactly why somewhere like Greensill collapsed.
Well, one might argue that maybe we should create some sort of economy where training is somewhat linked to employment, but it won't catch on.
But basically, so the guy who owns Greensill, who is called Lex Greensill.
Which is a very sinister name, don't you think?
Isn't that every Australian tycoon or business person? Like, they all have... Like, it's all, like, Lex Luthor-esque names.
No, I mean, the Lex...
You put Murdoch. I don't know if it sounds evil because... Like, which came first, chicken or the egg?
Did Murdoch sound evil
before or after Rupert Murdoch, you know? But Lex Greensill... has had close ties with the UK government for 20 years or so. Mm. Has been good friends with a ton of Whitehall folks and ex-Whitehall folks, and is really a his integration into Whitehall and the government is being called by some as kind of like a representation of the rotating door of like consultants and politics and that kind of thing. Basically, making sure that civil servants and politicians have jobs when they leave office.
Yeah, so specifically, Greensill worked with Jeremy Hayward, who was...
Jeremy Hayward.
Yes, the late Jeremy Hayward, who was a former cabinet secretary. Is that the top civil service job, or am I thinking of something else? I think that is. It's definitely one of the higher ones. Could Google it now. But they worked together at Morgan Stanley. And then when Jeremy Hayward was in the cabinet office, Greensill was given a desk where he was allowed to actually, this is according to the FT, he was given free rein to approach 11 departments to pitch financial solutions from everything from motorway schemes to major defence procurement programmes. That clip was actually from the Sunday Times, but I'm reading it from the FT, confusingly. But he even had a...
Nobody does their own journalism anymore, Jimmy.
He needs it. He even had a Downing Street business card and a secure email address.
Yeah, and we've seen that, haven't we?
You've seen the business card, have you?
Yeah, there was a photo of it that was circulated around the internet.
So it's all pretty cozy, isn't it? And then obviously when David Cameron left, quit as Prime Minister in 2016, a 2-year period elapsed during which there are sort of heavy restrictions on what employment former Prime Ministers can take up. And then once that...
Is it only 2 years?
It's only 2 years.
I think ban him from doing anything ever again. Like, it's fine if you want to stay on as a member of parliament, but anything else, no.
Well, the Economist's budget column this week discussed the whole Cameron lobbying scandal, and it made the point that actually previously prime ministers, because they tended to be a bit older, I guess because life expectancy was shorter, tended to have the dignity to die quite quickly after leaving office. But David Cameron was still in his 40s when he stopped being prime minister. And he's quite a rich guy, or probably lived into his 80s, I guess, if, with good headwind. So he's only halfway through his, slightly more than halfway through his life.
Oh my God. Oh, just, like, go to your tax haven and just hang out there. Like, the weather's nice. Just stop doing stuff.
The thing is, like, everyone, when he built this, he bought this, like, was it a 40 grand shed or something that he was using as a writing room?
Oh, yeah, his man shed. For his terrible autobiography. I haven't read it, but I've heard other people say that it was shit.
Well, that's good enough for me, Jazza. And everyone was taking the piss out of him, but, you know, at least he was keeping his nose out of, like, dodgy things like this at that point, I assume. Not entirely sure on the timelines, but it is difficult for, you know, I think we've heard sort of things like, did Gordon Brown take up some position at a financial company or, like, some management consultant? Obviously, George Osborne has had every job, basically. I think he's the only man who's had more jobs than me in the last 5 years. Yeah, there's a lot of people not behaving in a very dignified way, I guess. Once they left office,
Gordon Brown continued as a member of parliament for I think the next parliament, didn't he? And then there's the Gordon Sarah Brown Foundation. They have a charity that they run.
Yes,
isn't that what they do now? That's like their main thing. And then he also does some speaking. Like he's quite respected internationally as an economist, but he seems to be more in the public sector than in the private sector. I feel like Tony Blair did a similar thing where, well, he went off to the Middle East as a
consulted for the Kazakhstan
but also was meant to be in charge of like the peace process between Palestine and Israel, which famously white Catholics are really good at doing that. So,
didn't think we'd get in a dig at Catholics so early in the podcast.
I mean, there's always we've still got the next topic coming up, haven't we?
Tony Blair's had a mixed career. I mean, there was a book that came out called Blair Incorporated or something like that not so long ago, and he has been accused of profiteering, particularly on the speech making side, since he left office. But he's diverting a lot of his money into charitable causes now, to be fair to him.
Yeah, because he's a multi-millionaire. He doesn't need to, like...
Well, yeah, but, you know, David Cameron doesn't need the money that he pursued while
I refuse to applaud rich people who put some of their money into charities. I'm like, what else were you going to do with it? Anyway.
I've no response to that.
There's a couple of sides of this David Cameron thing that are particularly, that I think are like, there should be more concern around it. One is whether or not David Cameron was actually an employee.
He was employed, wasn't he?
Well, Jimmy, they have claimed that he's employed. So I'm reading from Private Eye here, who didn't. This was a relatively new story when this print came out, so there's not a huge amount in this edition. But from their most recent edition, they said that there is a very clear definition of what an employee is in the regulations, and that is, quote, an individual who works under a contract of employment. Nobody has provided that contract. They provided letters saying, can you do this, 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 and this, but nobody has seen an actual contract of employment between Greensill and David Cameron. So that is still kind of up in the air. There's also the fact, and this is why this was originally a story, there's also the fact that David Cameron was texting Rishi Sunak's private phone.
Yeah, so
and on the Rishi Sunak side, he didn't declare that as a lobbying effort. And then all this whole thing, because David Cameron was an employee, meant that it wasn't lobbying, it was an employee having a private conversation or whatever. But that's kind of what I really like is, though, that apparently David Cameron texted Rishi Sunak and Rishi Sunak ghosted him, which I love. That's the ultimate shade.
I love that this is the part of the story you most relate to. The
100%.
As someone who presumably has been ghosted and certainly ghosts me some of the time when I'm trying to get these podcasts arranged. Difficult man to get in touch with at the best of times. It is pretty funny, though. But it says here, again reading from the FT, that Greensill did end up with 10 meetings with senior Treasury officials, and that was on the basis of Rishi Sunak's encouragement. So obviously, you know, wherever Sunak responded to those particular text messages, something has happened that has led to Greensill getting these meetings. I suppose it's debatable what role Cameron's activity played in that specifically. But, I mean, the fact that this isn't described as lobbying is just absurd, because it is lobbying, isn't it?
Isn't it nuts? It's they've tied themselves in knots to say that, oh, no, this isn't lobbying because of this definition. David Cameron had interest in Greensill doing well and asked his old mate Rishi Sunak, who now has a very powerful job in the government, to consider it. That, I don't care about the dictionary definition, that is lobbying, and that is using your power and connections to get some more cash.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is about him being cleared of lobbying on the official basis, obviously, you know, to have... You need specific guidelines and a specific remit of what certain things cover and do cover to have a kind of legally enforceable regime on things like this. So I do get that. I mean, 2 years is crazy short, I think, in terms of him not having, you know, particular business interests and that kind of thing. Private Eye, since you mentioned it, has for years run stories on the revolving door between government and business. And has particularly criticised the toothless regime of, is it a COBA? Is that the Committee on Business Interests or Business Activity that's supposed to scrutinise Whitehall and Westminster people when they take jobs?
Are you asking me? I don't know.
I can't remember the name of the committee, but you know, this sort of shit has been going on for years, basically. And obviously the people who are in a position to tighten the rules have no incentive whatsoever to tighten them. So it's just kind of a classic incentives thing, I think. But yeah, so
there's also the thing of how much is this just gonna fuck up David Cameron's legacy? Because he's already got a really shitty one in the form of Brexit.
See, this is one point on which I disagree with a lot of pundits, because they say, oh, you know, it's tarnished his legacy even further. I'm like, he's only going to be remembered for one thing. If he's caught defecating in the street, it doesn't matter. That's not going to be the first line of his obituary.
I don't know. Do you know what I mean? I think him shitting in the middle of a road, Jimmy, is pretty high. That's all that Paula Radcliffe gets remembered for now, and she's got a ton of medals, isn't she?
Yeah, but I mean, the story around David Cameron is that he gambled on Britain's relationship with the EU, and it backfired in his face and tore his party apart. And probably, in terms of its own internal logic and what he was trying to achieve out of that, undoubtedly one of the worst prime ministerial decisions of the last 100 years, possibly longer.
So, interestingly, I have I bought Ian Dale's book on the prime ministers because it's 300 years since we got a prime minister
this week. Yeah,
which is quite cool, actually. There's only been 55 of them. I thought there'd have been more, but only 55.
Yeah. Well, the first one did Robert Walpole. He was around for like 30 years, wasn't he?
Yeah, wasn't he? Yeah, so loads of them.
That's
just
greedy, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Shocking behaviour.
But how dare he? But like at the beginning, like it's 55 essays for each of the prime ministers, and they each have at the beginning of the essay like a little quote that's meant to sum up that prime minister's
legacy,
kind of like legacy, yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, we know that Ian Dale is a fucking Tory. I shouldn't be so rude. We know that he is.
He's quite a lovable Tory, as it goes, don't you think?
Yeah, no, he's a very nice. He's actually a really lovely Tory. But they've chosen the quote about gay marriage. Like, I don't support gay marriage in spite of being a conservative. I support gay marriage because I'm a conservative. Interestingly, that was the quote that they went for rather than anything else. And I guess that there were some pretty positive things that came out of the coalition years, and also when gay marriage was put through, a majority of Conservative MPs voted against it. But we'll save the gay stuff until the next the next topic. I don't think anybody remembers that. People just remember him as like the guy who rolled the dice, who was too arrogant to kind of like take anyone's advice and rolled the dice on EU membership, lost it. And now he's also just got this sleaze of like the old Etonian old boys network thing going on.
Well, there was always the chumocracy story, I think, even before this Green Seal Capital thing came out. I think the gay marriage quote is quite a good quote for his legacy. Well, his premiership in the round,
his brand of conservatism.
Yeah, like anyway. I can totally see why they've chosen that, but it does mean they've missed an opportunity to requote that infamous Chaos Under Ed Miliband tweet that he sent, which surely is an absolute shoo-in, I'd have thought. The gist of which, for
I guess, he had to have
is,
said it, like their quotes that they've all said.
Well, I mean, written down is fine. So he said something like, "You can either vote for, what was it, stability under me or chaos under Ed Miliband."
Yeah.
And we know the rest is history, as they say. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are we done flogging Cameron? I mean, I'm sure he'll turn up at some later date, and we can stick the boot in again.
That'll be fun.
Something to look forward to, but we want to talk about a different leader who is accused of ineptness, Keir Starmer, mm-hmm. of the Labour Party. Do you want to introduce this story? Because you alerted me to it via Facebook. So what's
no,
going on?
I've already talked about it at length, I think, in the introduction. I'm curious what your take is. Just lay out your stall, please, Jimmy.
So, as you said, Keir Starmer went to this location.
It's a church.
It's a church, but it's not the main church of Jesus House, is it? As you were saying in the intro, it's a branch of Jesus House, which is an overall series of churches, you know, in the sort
of... Yeah, it's still a church, though.
Yeah, but, like, it's a sort of, like franchise model, isn't it? That's kind of what I'm getting
like
at.
You go to... Like, just because there's lots of M&Ss doesn't mean you have to go to the head M&S on Oxford Street in order to go to M&S. Like...
When I'm shopping at M&S, I go to their head office and demand to speak to the admin manager personally.
Okay.
Fair point. So he went to this Jesus House Church, which in Brent
Terrible
Cross,
name for a church, by the way.
They're all
it's just a bit
like,
on the nose.
They're
isn't
all
it?
They're all called like St Paul's or it's all the Saints, isn't it?
All Saints, literally as well. Sometimes.
Yeah, All Saints. Yeah,
that was my local church.
So he went to Jesus House.
Shout out to Father Richard.
Enough about your personal life. Jesus House in Brent Cross, Northwest London, and he praised it as a wonderful example of church serving its community during the pandemic. So it's been working as a food bank and as a vaccination centre, and he was basically very positive about it. And I guess they presumably booked this visit in as part of his outreach to, you know, to sort of black British voters.
Yeah, to the downtrodden Christian community as well.
Well, I mean, to be fair, there's a pretty... So, obviously, Christianity among white people in the UK is undergoing structural decline. I mean, you know, fewer church pews filled every single year, an ageing kind of followership, I suppose. And the Church of England is pretty screwed, really, in terms of its long-term prospects in the UK among white British people. Where there has actually been growth in the past couple of years has been from immigrant communities who've, particularly from... kind of African countries where Christianity is still relatively strong, and this, you know, as you said, this being a Nigerian, a church of Nigerian origin, is an example of that, really. And so, this presumably was an outreach effort from Keir Starmer. Mm-hmm. He was then criticised by the likes of Owen Jones and yourself, I suppose.
I'm flattered, Jimmy, but I don't think I don't think I exist in the same breath as
leading YouTuber Jazza John criticised Keir Starmer for attending this church because its leader is a homophobe and who's signed, you know, multiple letters.
I will say, I think he's a very polite homophobe.
Okay. You know? Well,
like, very balanced, that he doesn't believe I should have the same rights as a straight person.
So he's
please
anti,
go on, Jimmy.
He's anti same-sex marriage and other bits of equality legislation. As he said, in 2013, he signed a letter to the Telegraph opposing same-sex marriage. There's probably a tie-in with what you were saying about David Cameron that we missed out on there. Mm-hmm. Segues that we could have had. But the church has also been criticised for being involved in conversion therapy. And interestingly, the government is currently being criticised for its lack of action against conversion therapy.
It doesn't sound like they're actually planning on banning it.
Yeah. So
they just want to reduce it.
There's been a big push to ban conversion therapy where, you know, for instance, this church has been involved in sort of, well, they would describe it as exorcisms where, you know, the... there's no way of saying this that isn't offensive, but the sort of homosexual instincts are pulled out of a person through like prayer and that sort of thing is the theory.
No, I don't want to make you feel bad, Jimmy, but I think it's very telling that you're laughing about that and I don't think it's funny at all.
It's not funny. I mean, it is funny, but it's also not funny. I mean, it's very dark on another level. It's funny to me because it's so ridiculous that you could think that you could change somebody's sexuality by praying.
But people do
think that, and it has horrendous consequences for people who are brainwashed into thinking that is a good thing. But all that said, Keir Starmer didn't praise them for any of those things. He praised them for operating as
He praised Jesus.
I'm sorry,
I'll stop. Go on.
He praised them for operating as a community centre, as a food bank, and as a food bank, and as a vaccination centre. And I think if you're a political leader, you know, whether you're Tory or Labour or whoever else, And you want to reach out to some of these ethnic minority communities where the church still plays an important role in those communities' lives, you're going to come across a lot of institutions with very backwards views about things like homosexuality. And the implication to me from your position is that, I mean, is he not allowed to praise them for anything good that they've done? Does he have to condemn them across the board or not associate with them across the board? Because they have, you know, the leader has these terrible views about homosexuality.
I think that there are plenty of places that are doing really fantastic community stuff, even, I'm sure, in Brent. That are...
I did not expect the drive-by shooting on Brent that's just taken place. Please continue.
That would have also been fantastic representations of community outreach. Like,
okay, but you're changing the conversation. The fact is that there are communities.
Let me finish my bloody sentence, Mr. Nichols.
Okay.
People are allowed to be homophobic. But it is. I'm sorry, but the images of Keir Starmer of this pastor, Agu Irukuru, shaking the hand of every bloody politician who wants to go to a black church, are used as ringing endorsements and of legitimacy of his views. Like, it doesn't matter if the Labour Party thinks, like, the Labour Party stance on same-sex marriage or on conversion therapy or whatever, or whether you went to this place in order to say that they were doing really good things with food banks and vaccination drives and the like. Like, you going there is going to be used by this guy who... and I can't not make it personal, who has campaigned for me not to have the same rights as you, Jimmy. Those images are going to be used by this pastor in order to legitimise his views, whether or not Keir Starmer holds those views personally, which I don't believe that Keir Starmer does. And I wish that they were more selective and more careful about the... I wish they were more considerate about the people that they maybe inadvertently... endorsed with their presence. We have been equally critical about the fact that Jeremy Corbyn was photographed and has been in the same places as and lobbied alongside a ton of people who have horrific views on homosexuality. And I would be amiss to not criticize Keir Starmer of the same thing when I see a similar thing happen. So that's where I am. Like,
I think that the difference, but you're right to bring up the Corbyn comparison, because there are a lot of instances where he was associated with pretty shady people. Mm-hmm. I think one of the differences to me is that I don't think, throughout Corbyn's tenure, I don't remember it being a big topic of conversation that he was associating with homophobes. I think the angle was always that he was associating with terrorists and that he was, by implication, a terrorist.
Yeah, but who were also homophobes.
He wasn't being criticised for that.
I would say that's because the terrorism thing maybe overshadowed the homophobia thing.
The visits were... So the most infamous one was when he attended the reflaying for the Munich attackers, where he's actually pictured holding the reef. And I think the thing is, with Corbyn, there was always a bit of a lack of a smoking gun in terms of his sympathy for, you know, whether it be the IRA or, you know, various Islamist groups. That was the Munich reflaying was probably the closest thing that came to a smoking gun, I think, in relation to that. And it was because it wasn't that he was visiting these groups with which he disagreed. He was visiting these groups, and he was on platforms with people who, you know, represented his anti-Western foreign policy views, which I think, you know, he holds. So I think it's a bit different. Keir Starmer visiting this church, where, you know, there's no reason to think that Keir Starmer agrees with this church's views on homosexuality. There's plenty of reason to think that Jeremy Corbyn, you know, is anti-Western in his outlook on foreign policy, you know, was supportive of the RA's, you know, violent struggle against the British state, and, you know, was sympathetic to, you know,
but that's based on stuff that he's said, I feel like, not just the people that he's hung out with.
It's a bit of both, I think. Like, as I said, there's a bit of a lack of a smoking gun in that case. I think to sort of bring it back to Starmer, I do think the Corbyn comparison is interesting, but obviously, for Starmer to win and for Labour to win power, they're going to have to, you know, continue to muster ethnic minority support and votes ultimately. And in the case of, say, you know, certain, for instance, if you bring up sort of British Muslims, homophobia is pretty rife among British Muslims. Mm-hmm. If you look at all the polling, there's, you know, widespread condemnation of it. Even among younger generations of British Muslims. Mm-hmm. If Labour want to win those people's votes, they're going to have to go to a few mosques where the people running them do not have good views on those topics. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what exactly do you expect them to do? Do you expect them to go there and say, you know, we like what you're doing in the community, but your views on homosexuality are abhorrent? I don't really see how... You know, Starmer seems to be a bit of a bind with issues like this. And it's not just the, you know, retrograde Christians that are a problem. It's across the board, really.
Like, I... I agree with you, Jimmy, but like I would be most concerned if no one said anything when these kinds of things happened, whether or not it was an MP having dinner with kind of like a guy who was convicted of a kind of like sexual assault. I'm just plucking things out of the air at the moment. Giving a contract to a company where the boss said stuff that was sexist or racist or whatever. We need to call attention to that stuff and say, you sure you want this guy to be part of how you are represented to the world?
If I were
Keir Starmer, which to be clear I am not, I try and avoid that stuff as much as possible.
I think this is kind of redolent of a purist approach to political association that, you know, we sort of see it happens in business quite often, and we see it in like the boycott of J.K. Rowling's books, which we discussed on a previous episode because of her comments about the transgender issue.
Yeah.
It's just not practical. I mean, to quote no less an authority than Barack Obama, you need to get over that shit pretty quickly.
It's not practical to be able to do it for absolutely everything, but you can have a value that...
What's the criteria then? For
I don't know. You just do your best, Jimmy. You just do your best. And when I see someone who might be the next prime minister hanging out and praying with somebody who... Like, conversion therapy is really horrific. And does huge damage. It's one of the I know people who are from like the West African queer community who have had horrible experiences with this kind of stuff. I wouldn't touch that shit with a barge pole, and I'd like it if the next leader of our country maybe did the same thing. But I know that I can't make that happen, but I'm still going to say it'd be great if somebody made that judgment call. You know what? And also disappointed in someone like Dawn Butler, who I actually quite liked up until this point. What are you doing, mate?
So Dawn Butler is an MP for...
Is the local MP local for MP. That church, yeah. So inevitably probably has links there.
I think that there seems to be a very prominent attitude among progressive activists that you can't do business with anybody whose politics you have some problem with, and that's just not workable, is it, in a wider sense? Like, I get this whole thing about, oh, you have to try your best. It's like, well, you're going to have to pick and choose some battles at the end of the day.
Yeah, right? And this is a battle I chose.
Okay.
It's probably not a battle that Keir Starmer chose. We're all going to choose different battles, right? And we can't fight every single battle, but we try. We have the values that we kind of like stand by, and we're not going to get it right or be able to be pure all of the time. Like, even Greta Thunberg, when she's sailing across the blooming Atlantic, has a plastic bottle behind her in a photo, right? Like, nobody is Jesus apart from Jesus. And he is risen, yes, praise be.
And on this holy Easter Sunday, that may be an appropriate way to wrap things up, I guess.
You're welcome. Oh, well, it's quite poetic, actually.
That was very poetic. Jazza, you're a good internet boy. Where can people find you on the internet?
Just type in Jazza John, isn't it?
I mean, if you guys haven't already followed Jazza on all social media platforms, what are you doing with your life?
Probably something productive.
You're still doing your Pokemon Let's Plays, I'm assuming.
I finished it on Friday. Thanks, fake fan. I finished it by losing. So I lost my Nuzlocke. I died to Lance. Spoiler.
It was actually really
sad. I'm quite tender about it. I will be taking no more questions at this time.
Okay. You can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter. Or you can join my Substack. I still need people on my Substack.
Oh, I'm subscribed to that.
Yeah, I don't think you read it very often.
It's, no.
No.
But you know what I do, Jimmy? I keep the emails as unread so that I then click through at a later date when I want to do a little bit of a Jimmy Nichols binge.
That's interesting.
So the intention is there. That's all I'm saying.
Wow.
Jimmy, okay?
Good intentions are always welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right, let's wrap it up there.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.